Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. Tonight, I want to talk to you about the crossroads that we're at. I believe that we're going to be confronted with something that's going to ask us to make a decision. We don't want to be standing there going, I guess that way. The only way we can move forward intelligently is to learn history and understand the influences of the past. A very wise man said to me recently, he said, Glenn, you don't ever run from something. You run to something. Well, let's figure out where we want to run. It's time to tell the story of America. Hello, America. I want to tell you a story that really kind of happened here in America. It's going to solve so many problems. There are so many questions. So we were just talking. We have a studio audience in today. And I had just said right before we went on the air, it's amazing that free enterprise system lasted as long as it has. Because everybody kind of knows why it works or that they believe in it, but they don't know exactly how it works or why they believe in it. You will after the end of the program tonight. I want to start in 1945. The guns had finally drawn silent in Western Europe. The bombs had stopped falling. The skies were no longer filled with the scream of the fighter planes. The invasions were over. The battles were finished. The Allied forces had won. World War II was over. But this was not the end. This was the beginning of what we're facing right now. Perhaps, maybe even a more important war was just beginning in 1945. Europe was decimated politically, structurally. They faced the daunting task of starting over from scratch. They had the opportunity to start over from the beginning. Clean slate. Unfortunately, it was a confused time. Americans had just come off the Great Depression. Many believed it was caused by the evil, greedy capitalist system. That's what our people had been taught here since 1931. The question that loomed largest over many countries around the entire globe and here in America is, what do we do now? Now what? I mean, it was an economic collapse, they thought, that caused all of this. Should we risk another economic collapse? How about if we let the government control the economy? Sure, I know fascism and a dictatorship, it's bad because it led to Mussolini, but a lot of people back then thought Mussolini was okay until the very end. Hitler. Okay, there was a really bad example of Hitler, but maybe it was just the wrong guy running the economy. The eventual deciding factor in the war after the war came from a very unlikely source. He was an unknown. He was originally from Vienna. His name was Friedrich A. Hayek. I bring him up today because he's kind of an aha moment for a lot of people. We're in a similar war today, but if you don't know history, you don't know about this man. If you don't know history, you can't make the decisions that we need to make. Starting in the early 1940s, Hayek began writing a little book called The Road to Serfdom. The book clearly and logically explained how any form of central government planning usually leads to serfdom or servitude, slavery. It extinguishes freedom. He wrote this because he couldn't understand why Great Britain was doing this. He didn't do it because of fortune or notoriety. In fact, it was the opposite. Material like this was banned everywhere. Germany banned it. He was writing it because he considered it, and to quote him, a duty which I must not evade, end quote. He believed that there was a real possibility that Europe and America would move in the same direction as fascist Italy, or Germany without the mustache, or Stalin. After all, England had been, you know, in bed with a Fabian socialist, and Europe, England was starting to do all of the nationalized stuff. If you don't know what the Fabian socialists are, ooh, You look them up. Fabian socialists are kind of like our evil early 20th century progressives. George Bernard Shaw, who I showed you in our documentary, The Revolutionary Holocaust, he was a Fabian socialist. Give you a little taste of what they believed. Here he is.
I don't want to punish anybody, but there are an extraordinary number of people whom I want to kill. I think it would be a good thing to make everybody come before a properly appointed board, just as he might come before the income tax commissioner, and say every 5 years or every 7 years, just put him there and say, sir or madam, now will you be kind enough to justify your existence?
This is a Fabian socialist. This is the kind of stuff that our progressives here in the early 20th century. And do your own homework, America. Do not allow people just to say, that's ridiculous. Do your own homework. Look up their words. Frightening. Well, Hayek couldn't live with himself if he didn't write what he was thinking. He didn't know if anybody would read the book. He initially wrote the book for just the British because he saw George Bernard Shaw, a man who we now are taught in school as a genius. He could see the road that the British were traveling down. He had no earthly idea that it would take off and people would really read it. But it did take off. First, he couldn't even find a publisher. Everybody was like, what? Are you kidding me? They only printed 2,000 copies. That was gone overnight. Within 6 months, 30,000 copies were sold. American publishers, they were skeptical. They were also skeptical of this author as well. They said, Ayn Rand, she didn't really understand communism or socialism. She lived in Russia. Well, they didn't think it would work here in America. And ironically, when they was pitching it, they tried to get progressive icon Walter Lippmann, as evil as this guy, as George Bernard Shaw. Walter Lippmann, read his words. They wanted him to do the foreword for this book, noting that if Lippmann did it, well, it would sell thousands, and if he didn't, maybe it would only sell 900. Well, Lippmann wasn't able to write it, and so it went off, and they published very few. It was huge. The book went through 6 impressions in 16 months. It was translated into foreign languages left and right, circulated openly in the free world, and as you will find out by the end of the program tonight, underground, the underground behind the Iron Curtain, people literally risked their lives to read it. It took off here in America after Reader's Digest published a condensed version of the book in 1945. Reader's Digest had a circulation at the time of 5 million people, and the little journal was provided to every American serviceman, a home and abroad, and they read it. And they got it. And they loved it. And I think they loved it because it's easy to understand. It is, as Thomas Paine said, common sense. Things like this. A man does not and cannot know everything. And when he acts as if he does, disaster follows. Good common sense. Hayek explained that capitalism is the only system of economics compatible with human dignity, prosperity, and liberty. He demonstrated that planned economies that tried to control the nature of man through administrative rules was impossible. This is important because that's what we're trying to do now. He said it would only lead to one outcome, serfdom, slavery. The message spread like a ripple on a pond, and soon terms like collectivism, which she was against, were erased from political debate. Anyone defending government central planning was discredited. This book was like Mike Tyson in his prime, right hook to socialism in Western Europe and in the United States. But the influence didn't stop there. It has inspired political and economic leaders for decades since. Most famously, you know who loved this book? Ronald Reagan. Reagan praised Hayek. He talked about people waking up to the dangers of big government. He said this guy did it. That brings us to today. We're in trouble. We have fallen off the wagon. We don't even know what we're doing anymore. People can't defend their point of view. A few years ago, this is probably 5 years ago, I started asking myself questions, and I bet you every single member of the audience has asked themselves this. Maybe you have. How did this happen to us? How did we get here? How are we here? Nobody had any answers. I started reading history. It didn't take long for me to realize that we were completely disconnected from our own history, making us incredibly vulnerable to repeating the mistakes of the past. If you don't know the past, you will repeat it. Look what we're doing. We now have a government car company, a government bank. We're talking about government oil companies, government hiring all the workers. 411,000 for the census, $14.5 billion to count people. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. Tonight, I want to talk to you about the crossroads that we're at. I believe that we're going to be confronted with something that's going to ask us to make a decision. We don't want to be standing there going, I guess that way. The only way we can move forward intelligently is to learn history and understand the influences of the past. A very wise man said to me recently, he said, Glenn, you don't ever run from something. You run to something. Well, let's figure out where we want to run. It's time to tell the story of America. Hello, America. I want to tell you a story that really kind of happened here in America. It's going to solve so many problems. There are so many questions. So we were just talking. We have a studio audience in today. And I had just said right before we went on the air, it's amazing that free enterprise system lasted as long as it has. Because everybody kind of knows why it works or that they believe in it, but they don't know exactly how it works or why they believe in it. You will after the end of the program tonight. I'm going to start in 1945. The guns had finally drawn silent in Western Europe. The bombs had stopped falling. The skies were no longer filled with the scream of the fighter planes. The invasions were over. The battles were finished. The Allied forces had won. World War II was over. But this was not the end. This was the beginning of what we're facing right now. Perhaps, maybe even a more important war was just beginning in 1945. Europe was decimated politically, structurally. They faced the daunting task of starting over from scratch. They had the opportunity to start over from the beginning. Clean slate. Unfortunately, it was a confused time. Americans had just come off the Great Depression. Many believed it was caused by the evil, greedy capitalist system. That's what our people had been taught here since 1931. The question that loomed largest over many countries around the entire globe and here in America is, what do we do now? Now what? I mean, it was an economic collapse, they thought, that caused all of this. Should we risk another economic collapse? How about if we let the government control the economy? Sure, I know fascism and a dictatorship, it's bad because it led to Mussolini, but a lot of people back then thought Mussolini was okay until the very end. Hitler. Okay, there was a really bad example of Hitler, but maybe it was just the wrong guy running the economy. The eventual deciding factor in the war after the war came from a very unlikely source. He was an unknown. He was originally from Vienna. His name was Friedrich A. Hayek. I bring him up today because he's kind of an aha moment for a lot of people. We're in a similar war today, but if you don't know history, you don't know about this man. If you don't know history, you can't make the decisions that we need to make. Starting in the early 1940s, Hayek began writing a little book called The Road to Serfdom. The book clearly and logically explained how any form of central government planning usually leads to serfdom or servitude, slavery. It extinguishes freedom. He wrote this because he couldn't understand why Great Britain was doing this. He didn't do it because of fortune or notoriety. In fact, it was the opposite. Material like this was banned everywhere Germany banned it. He was writing it because he considered it, and to quote him, a duty which I must not evade, end quote. He believed that there was a real possibility that Europe and America would move in the same direction as fascist Italy, or Germany without the mustache, or Stalin. After all, England had been, you know, in bed with a Fabian socialist, and Europe, England was starting to do all of the nationalized stuff. If you don't know what the Fabian socialists are, ooh, you look them up. Fabian socialists are kind of like our evil early 20th century progressives. George Bernard Shaw, who I showed you in our documentary, The Revolutionary Holocaust, he was a Fabian socialist. Give you a little taste of what they believed. Here he is.
Not to punish anybody, but there are an extraordinary number of people whom I want to kill. I think it would be a good thing to make everybody come before a properly appointed board, just as he might come before the income tax commissioners, and say every 5 years or every 7 years, just put him there and say, sir or madam, now will you be kind enough to justify your existence?
This is a Fabian socialist. This is the kind of stuff that our progressives here in the early 20th century. And do your own homework, America. Do not allow people just to say, that's ridiculous. Do your own homework. Look up their words. Frightening. Well, Hayek couldn't live with himself if he didn't write what he was thinking. He didn't know if anybody would read the book. He initially wrote the book for just the British because he saw George Bernard Shaw, a man who we now are taught in school as a genius. He could see the road that the British were traveling down. He had no earthly idea that it would take off and people would really read it. But it did take off. First, he couldn't even find a publisher. Nobody ever was like, what? Are you kidding me? They only printed 2,000 copies. That was gone overnight. Within 6 months, 30,000 copies were sold. American publishers, they were skeptical. They were also skeptical of this author as well. They said, Ayn Rand, she didn't really understand communism or socialism. She lived in Russia. Well, they didn't think it would work here in America. And ironically, when they was pitching it, they tried to get progressive icon Walter Lippmann, as evil as this guy, as George Bernard Shaw. Walter Lippmann, read his words. They wanted him to do the foreword for this book, noting that if Lippmann did it, well, it would sell thousands, and if he didn't, maybe it would only sell 900. Well, Lippmann wasn't able to write it, and so it went off, and they published very few. It was huge. The book went through 6 impressions in 16 months. It was translated into foreign languages left and right, circulated openly in the free world, and as you will find out by the end of the program tonight, underground. The underground behind the Iron Curtain, people literally risked their lives to read it. It took off here in America after Reader's Digest published a condensed version of the book in 1945. Reader's Digest had a circulation at the time of 5 million people, and the little journal was provided to every American serviceman, a home and abroad, and they read it. And they got it. And they loved it. And I think they loved it because it's easy to understand. It is, as Thomas Paine said, common sense. Things like this. A man does not and cannot know everything. And when he acts as if he does, disaster follows. Good common sense. Hayek explained that capitalism is the only system of economics compatible with human dignity, prosperity, and liberty. He demonstrated that planned economies that tried to control the nature of man through administrative rules was impossible. This is important because that's what we're trying to do now. He said it would only lead to one outcome, serfdom, slavery. The message spread like a ripple on a pond. And soon terms like collectivism, which she was against, were erased from political debate. Anyone defending government central planning was discredited. This book was like Mike Tyson in his prime, right hook to socialism in Western Europe and in the United States. But the influence didn't stop there. It has inspired political and economic leaders for decades since. Most famously, you know who loved this book? Ronald Reagan. Reagan praised Hayek. He talked about people waking up to the dangers of big government. He said this guy did it. That brings us to today. We're in trouble. We have fallen off the wagon. We don't even know what we're doing anymore. People can't defend their point of view. A few years ago, this is probably 5 years ago, I started asking myself questions, and I bet you every single member of the audience has asked themselves this. Maybe you have. How did this happen to us? How did we get here? How are we here? Nobody had any answers. I started reading history. It didn't take long for me to realize that we were completely disconnected from our own history, making us incredibly vulnerable to repeating the mistakes of the past. If you don't know the past, you will repeat it. Look what we're doing. We now have a government car company, a government bank. We're talking about government oil companies, government hiring all the workers. 411,000 for the census, $14.5 billion to count people. That's $10 billion more than what we had 10 years ago. We're there, gang. And Hayek demonstrates this road leads to one destination. Now, I have to tell you, my copy of this book doesn't look like this. It doesn't even have a picture on the cover. And the first time I opened this book, I said, oh, you got to be kidding. It's like, I mean, I've read The Roots of Modern Liberalism by, on Woodrow Wilson. And I needed rope to hang myself. I mean, look at the bottom of each of these pages. It's all footnotes. It sat at my desk for a while, and I'm like, I can't read that thing. It's the best thing you could read. There's a reason this book was banned in places like Germany and the Soviet Union. In just a few minutes, I'm going to introduce you to somebody who risked his freedom to read this. 7 years in prison. If he was caught giving this book to somebody else, 12 years of hard labor, that was a certain death sentence. He did it. Why? Why? For a book that sat on my desk. I didn't want to read. It was too hard. Nobody has even heard of. I mean, connected people, but the average person, you go down the street and say, hey, have you read this? No. Why did people risk their lives to read this? They knew over in the Soviet Union, if people would read this man's words, the tyrants would be over. Now, here in America, we're not banning books. We're not dishing out hard labor sentences. No, no, no. We can just watch television and be distracted. But there, while we're being distracted, there is something here that I think is pretty shocking. There is a publisher, we just found this yesterday, selling copies of the Constitution. But when you buy the Constitution, I want to show you what comes along with the Constitution. There it is. Show the disclaimer. There's a disclaimer now with the Constitution. This book is a product of its time and does not reflect the same values as it would if it were written today. You got that one right. Parents might wish to discuss with their children how views on race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and interpersonal relations have changed since this book was written before allowing them to read this classic work. That is the U.S. Constitution with a disclaimer. There is a war for the future of mankind. There is a war for the future of this country. It is being waged right now, but it doesn't feel like a war because they've got to keep you asleep. Wake up, America! The questions of our future can always be answered with information. And I hate to disagree with those in Washington, but there ain't such a thing as too much information. We can figure it out. If you have information, you see the glories and the mistakes of our past. It's okay. It's the only way you can see the truth. Today, we're going to give you another option. Because Everybody says capitalism is bad. Everything's too greedy. Everything's too big to fail. We got to spend, spend, spend. Let's go to global governance. Let's control everything through a giant progressive monolith. You know what? If you're like I was just a few years ago, you kind of just shrug your shoulders and say, well, I don't know. What else do you do? There is another road. If you don't learn the things that no one is willing to teach today, there is going to be a lot more than a disclaimer on our Constitution. I'm going to introduce you in just a second to a couple of people that know about this book a lot more than I do, can explain it to you, and then I'm going to introduce you to the guy who risked going to jail. Wait until you hear his story coming up in just a second. Today we're talking about the book Road to Serfdom. F.A. Hayek published it in the 1940s. And, you know, I don't have a warning label for it, but total government leads to a loss of freedom. That's what it should say right on the cover. Hayek pointed out that total government needed propaganda and somebody to blame a scapegoat. Those people. But the good news is we don't ever do that. Right?
The party is over. The era of golden parachutes for high-flying Wall Street operators is over.
I refuse to let America go back to the culture of irresponsibility and greed that made it possible. Back to an economy with soaring CEO salaries and shrinking middle-class incomes.
They're thinking the same old thing that got us here, greed.
I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street. I don't sit around just talking to experts because this is a college seminar. We talk to these folks because they potentially had the best answers, so I know who's asked to kick.
I've never heard a president say anything like that. And it's not the A word that bothers me. It's justice. You're there to make sure that justice is applied, not to kick people's ass. Thomas E. Woods, Jr., he's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, author of the upcoming book, Nullification, How to Resist Federal Tyranny in the 21st Century. We're talking about Road to Serfdom. I don't know what happened to my copy. Here it is. Road to Serfdom. When we were talking about propaganda, you've got to find a bad guy first, yep. Right? And you got to sell that.
Yeah, absolutely. In the Soviet Union, it's the saboteur, it's bad weather, it's conspirators. I mean, you see it in the book Animal Farm. That's essential. And what helps also in our case is that American kids, from the time they're in first grade, are taught a narrative of American history in which the government is there. They're composed of wonderful, selfless public servants. Mm-hmm. The public sector is full of people who, if they had their chance, they would employ you in the mines 100 hours a week at 2 cents a day. And we certainly don't want to go back to that. So thank heavens for our wise overlords. And people believe this. Okay, a lot of our people believe.
So what does he say in Road to Serfdom about greed or about capitalism or the free market system and being able to have sanity, because that's what he's after, greedy people.
If you look at centrally planned economies, which is the target of his book, are we going to say those economies are not organized by greed? Except the greed is placed differently. This time it's the greed of the bureaucrats, the apparatchiks. There's always a two-tier system. In this case,
the labor unions here.
The labor unions. But in the centrally planned economies, it was the people running the show. They got the good cars, they got the medical care, and everybody else, in effect, was a serf. So you're going to say that system isn't run by greed?
How different is that, though? Let me ask the audience. I mean, who gets the good medical care? Now, under this new system that they have, who gets the best medical care?
Congress.
Yeah, Congress. Yeah. Congress gets it. So, I mean, it's the same exact story. But they also, and you've touched on it here, they also want to make everybody in Washington, and this is Woodrow Wilson 101, the administrators have nothing to gain, so they're good guys. That gives them the power to distribute wealth and to have welfare systems. What is the road to serfdom? What does that even mean?
Well, when he talks about the road to serfdom, what he's warning about is that people think that there's a way to centrally plan an economy or run a society or engage in some sort of planning that doesn't involve methods we would find utterly distasteful and barbaric. And that, in fact, when what you think you're doing is bringing about prosperity for everybody, what you're instead doing is moving us along a road that can lead to places nobody wants to go to, all in the name of providing everybody with security, just like a serf. A serf had security. He was going to be fed. Sure, he's stuck on the land. He can't choose his occupation. And some other person has an initial claim on his income, but he's not going to die.
Right.
And so in exchange for that, you get security.
And the reason why Europe didn't mind serfdom is because they had come out of slavery. Slavery, serfdom, we view as slavery, not hard slavery, like early colonial America and the rest of the world, not in chains, et cetera, but serfdom was slavery light. It was, you work, you do your own hours, whatever, you just give me the bushel of grain.
Right.
And you can marry whoever you want, so it's not slavery. But that's kind of the system we're creating here, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And it's starting to come apart, especially as we see in Europe. A lot of these impossible promises that governments have made, all with supposedly good intentions, are coming apart. And in the meantime, the citizens have become so tethered to government, they don't know how to live otherwise. So now we're going to start to see riots across Europe. The possibility that people in their 20s, in their teens, could have a decent life is being destroyed by systems that are going to require these kids, because of the aging of the population, to work until they're ready to drop dead. They will never be able to retire. And the system's going to collapse anyway. And if anybody thinks that a few speeches delivered off a teleprompter is going to fix that, then the government schools are worse than we thought.
Let me ask you this, because I cannot convince 80% of the country, 90% of the country, even people are on my side, that there's no difference between the socialists of the Nazi regime and the socialists of the communist regime. Isn't he the first guy that said, there's no difference here? There's no difference.
He has a chapter in the book called The Socialist Roots of Nazism, which is a very unfashionable thing to say, because we all think that National Socialism is about wearing funny hats and having a swastika. But he's getting to the root of what is it really about? And what it's really about is a hatred of the old classical liberal, by which I mean free market order. That's what it is hatred of. And that's why it was very easy for people to move from one party to the other, be a communist one day, a Nazi the next. What you share in common is the common enemy. You hate the free market. You have to engage in some sort of planning. And, of course, Hitler, it wasn't too difficult for him to find what his enemy would be.
See, here's the problem. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day. To understand the reaction of 1913 and giving us the Fed, you have to understand the collapse of 1908. And to understand that one, you have to understand, what was it, 1893. I mean, free markets come up and they collapse. They come up and they collapse. It's a cycle. But that's how they get you, because they say, we're not going to have that. Don't worry about that. We're going to take, that was the promise of the central bank. We're going to take all that risk out.
And yet what's interesting, Glenn, is that what they always do is they create these problems and then they pose as the ones who are going to solve them. If you look at the period from 1873 to the time of the Fed, Canada is not actually having bank panics. So how come in the U.S. we see them again and again? It's because of regulation, it turns out. More regulation, less stability, believe it or not. At the state level, many of the states imposed unit banking laws, said every bank can have only one office. Well, that obviously makes every bank extremely fragile and undiversified. So when it came time for the Great Depression, 9,000 U.S. banks fail. You know how many Canadian banks fail? Zero. And it's not because Canada had a central bank to rescue them. They didn't get their central bank till the mid-1930s. So they give us the phony narrative, and then they pose as the saviors, and people go for this.
When we come back, I want to introduce you to a man who risked jail just to read this book. I want to introduce you to somebody who understands the loss of freedom. And can you think of a book that you would... Can you even imagine yourself possibly going to jail to read a book? You'll meet him next. Tonight I have a story that you must hear. You must ask yourself at the end of this hour, what is America's future? What are we facing? And where do we go from here? What is your role in that decision? You probably have either heard or have said to somebody yourself, oh, this book, it changed my life. Did it really? And how much did you have vested in that book? How difficult was it for you to read? My next guest, he knows about the road to serfdom. First, you have to understand what he went through just to read the book, 1971 Soviet Union. If he was caught reading The Road to Serfdom, if anybody was caught reading Road to Serfdom, he could go to jail. You can find it in any library. You can go to the bookstore right now. You can go to Amazon, click, and get it. He would go to jail. The friend who gave him the book could get 12 years of hard labor for disseminating anti-socialist propaganda. He read the Road to Serfdom, and it changed his life. Years later, he, and I use this term, I know you're going to correct me on it, defected from the Soviet Union. His name is Yuri Maltsev. He is the professor of economics at Carthage College. Yes, somebody who grew up in the Soviet Union teaching economics. And he's better than all the clowns in Washington. He is also the editor of Requiem for Marx. How are you, sir?
Well, thank you. I'm very well.
I have been looking forward to speaking to you today because you were actually in college when you read it. And you were allowed to read this book, but it was like one of those books that was kept under lock and key, right?
Yes. Later, after I read the book, I've changed my major to economic history and history of economic thought. So then they gave me permission to read under closed doors, and I would write kind of a pledge that I will never tell anybody about the book, which I'm breaking right now.
Well, you might be arrested by our own DOJ any day soon on this. When you read it, what was it that connected with you?
What was amazing for me, it was kind of like developing a film. I mean, a lot of things that I was thinking about, because if you were born in the Soviet Union, raised in Soviet Union, then you can see a country which was really too big to fail, failed. And it was not providing enough food, enough clothes, enough housing, enough anything for those people. And we were trying to figure out why. And definitely, we're looking for answers. And these answers were all there in this.
Did you ever discuss them in college? You could read it, but could you then discuss it and say, hey, we're doing all these things. Maybe that's the problem.
Yes, then you would discuss it in Eastern Siberia and hard labor camp.
Right.
And no, I would discuss it only with people I trusted. Back in all socialist countries, usually people would have a group of people whom they trust. And then, otherwise it would be impossible to survive. But you were all the time very much aware that you could be reported.
My wife brought me to the mall this weekend. And that's always a great experience. Standing there with the dresses by the, you know, by the hangers, and she's in the other room. You're just like, no, I don't need any help. Nothing fits me in this dress size. But so I was standing there, and people kept coming up to me. And what I found absolutely amazing is every person that came up to me in the mall that weekend or this last weekend was either from Cuba. Or they were from a former Soviet Union country. And they were all coming up and saying the same thing. You got to keep going. Americans don't get it. They don't see it. Can you explain what that even means?
Absolutely, because that's the people who saw the devil in the eye. I traveled quite a lot with my students to Cuba, because if you go to Cuba, it's the best inoculation against socialism that you can ever have.
No, no, you didn't see the Michael Moore film. No, I've heard they have tremendous health care.
This is so disgusting. It's agitprop of Soviet type. I mean, the Sicko, you mean, movie?
Yeah.
Yes, it's there's only one health care kind of in Cuba. It's to swim to Miami right away. There's no other healthcare system. I've been to Cuba many times, and I can attest to that.
So what is it that you see that the regular American doesn't see?
Well, I think that people are taking liberty, freedom, as granted. And that's why many of us, they think that it will be all the time here. And they don't see the symptoms of this awful disease which ruined the country I came from. Because the Soviet Union, can you imagine, was a country of 11 time zones, of almost everything. And the country would became dirt poor, completely devastated by its own government, which murdered over 50 million people,
including
my own grandfather.
I know that our producer asked you, because you just kind of glossed over that, and our producer said, wait, can you go back to that? And the notes that I read before I met you, you don't even know how he died or why they killed him, right?
Yes, well, I mean, the family, there is a story that he was asked to build dacha for Stalin. He was an architect, And he said, I'll do that after I'll finish my current project. And that was already a death sentence at that time. Stalin created, I think, the regime of random murders. And then everybody is scared. If you kill people because they're anti-communists or because they belong to this race or to that ethnicity, then people, at least some people, can feel themselves in safety. Stalin was murdering everybody. So nobody could figure out how to change their behavior, and that's why the scare is still in Russian people who elected Colonel of the KGB as the president.
I was reading, which is amazing. I read diaries. I've been reading diaries. We're doing some specials, and I'm reading diaries of people that were Jewish in Germany. And they said, we didn't trust anyone. And now, afterwards, we still don't really trust anyone. Once you've lived in that kind of society for a while, in that country, afterwards, you're still kind of... Was he wrong, or is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
America, we're going to come back in just a second. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Hayek and the road to serfdom. But as I sit here and look at a man who risked his life to read a book that it may not change your life. You may read it and go, It may change your life. But you have the opportunity to go online and grab something that he risked his life to read. Aren't you just a little curious on why somebody who is building a giant state government wouldn't want you to read it? And aren't you just a little curious, if this is the first time you've ever heard of Road to Serfdom, why that is? Gosh, it seems like a pretty important book. Why don't we teach this everywhere? Decide for yourself. Go online now and order it, Road to Serfdom. Back in just a second.
Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here. Welcome back, or welcome to the show. I'm discussing earlier the affirmative action ruling. Tomorrow is going to be the rulings on same-sex marriage. Obviously, I'll have a lot to say about that. Be on Fox and Friends before that in the morning in case you're an early riser. But right now, I have one of my favorite people, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, for which I write online, and I'm very delighted to do so. And he has a book out by my own publisher, Broadside, at HarperCollins, but it's irrelevant. I'm just mentioning it as a matter of my being familiar with the excellent imprint, but it's not why I'm having him on. Lincoln Unbound, How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Save the American Dream, and How We Can Do It Again. Oh, how we can do it again. Rich Lowry, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show.
Hey, Dennis. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for your columns. You always manage to stir up a hornet's nest.
Yeah, I do, don't I?
It's a good quality to have as a columnist.
Yeah, but I don't write vindictively.
You write truthfully, and that's enough.
Well, that's right. That's what I think. Thank you for that. It's a real pleasure. By the way, I just want to say you guys do a beautiful job. I mean, it's beautifully artistically laid out. The editing is professional. You have a lot of pride at that website, and I want to, you know, it's completely unsolicited, and I wanted to tell you that.
Thank you. We appreciate that very much. We have a lot of good people working hard. So
you certainly do. That is the truth. I know that. Now, I'll start with a challenging question. I could see somebody saying, we need another book on Lincoln like we need a hole in the head. So justify thyself.
Absolutely. Well, I think there's so much about Lincoln that has to do with what I would consider the what and the how. We know about the events of the Civil War. We know about his war leadership. We know about the assassination. This book, I believe, really gets to the why of Lincoln, going back to the story of his rise and how that undergirded everything about his politics and his policies. It's all about creating more of an opportunity society, and I believe this is a Lincoln that's most important for us to understand and to focus on in this moment when I believe we really have a crisis of opportunity in this country.
Yeah, we certainly do. So you focus on his early years.
Yeah, very little war. I do some consequences, social and economic, of the war in chapter. But the rest of it focuses on his rise and how that played out in his career and in his philosophy. And the story is, in a nutshell, you know, he comes from nothing in Kentucky and Indiana and the roughest sort of environment you can imagine. Some of his neighbors in Indiana reported that when they had fires going at night in their log cabins, they would see the glowing eyes of bears peering in. So it's a very rough country, and his ambition all along was to leave it and to do something else. And we associate him with the axe. We associate him as we call him the rail splitter. I even have that in my subtitle. He never wanted to split another damn rail in his life. He wanted to turn his back on that and make something better. And there's a story he told in the White House decades later about when he was a boy. He had this rowboat the side of the Ohio River. Two gentlemen pull up with their luggage. They want to meet the steamboat coming down the middle of the river. They ask him if he'll row them out. He rows them out. As they're getting on the steamboat and about to steam away, he says, hey, wait a minute, you forgot to pay me. And to his shock, they both threw down a silver half dollar on the bottom of his boat. And he said, decades later in the White House, I realized at that moment I had earned my first dollar. I was an optimistic and more hopeful being from that time. And what he wanted basically was an America where you could earn money and where you had to earn money, where you could make your own way up and you had to make your own way up.
I'm listening, by sheer coincidence, I'm listening to, I think it's the Learning Company, to Gelzo.
Yeah.
Who has done a lot of work on Lincoln.
Wonderful historian.
Yeah. And I'm listening to his teaching of it. And he is quite emphatic that Abraham Lincoln was a very ambitious man.
Oh, ferociously. I mean, there's no doubt about that. His law partner, William Herndon, who wrote a biography of him, early biography, and also just a great a treasure for all time to come, he did all these interviews and exchanged all these letters with pretty much anyone who knew Lincoln, especially in the early years. And it's a wonderful treasure today. But he said that Lincoln's ambition was the engine that didn't stop. And we tend to ambition, we tend to have mixed feelings about it. Oftentimes when you say someone's very ambitious, there's an air of criticism.
Right,
for that.
Right.
But Lincoln realized early on that he was an exceptional person and had an exceptional mind, and he was absolutely determined to make the most of it. And people around him realized this, especially his stepmother, who was very encouraging and a great blessing to him. He had a very complicated relationship with his father, who might not have appreciated his son's talent, and if he did, he might have envied it or resented it. Certainly, Lincoln resented his father and thought he had kind of held him back, and they had a chilly, kind of almost non-existent relationship the rest of their days.
Did he attend his father's funeral?
He did not.
Right.
He did not. He said he wrote a letter saying, I think it'd be more painful than pleasant. And Lincoln resented the fact that until he was age 21, his dad had the right to hire him out and to neighbors to do all sorts of backbreaking labor and then to take all the money. And Lincoln said in a speech years later about this is self-pitying and an exaggeration, but he said, I used to be a slave. And Lincoln just felt so deeply what he thought was one of the foundational principles of life, quoted from Genesis all the time, through the sweat of thy brow thou shalt eat thy bread. Or as he said, he who earns the corn should eat the corn. So if you're taking away the proceeds of someone's labor, that is a violation of natural rights. He thought his dad did it to him. And much more importantly, and much more seriously, he realized the South was doing it to an entire class of people. And that was basically the basis on which he opposed slavery. It was, as he said in the second inaugural, unrequited toil. It was taking the proceeds of other people's labor. It was theft.
What was his relationship to religion?
Complicated. He, especially when he's a young man, he is very much a creature of the Enlightenment, and there's a story, I don't know how much credence to put in it, that he actually wrote an anti-religious tract that his friends threw in the fire. It's a story that sounds a little too dramatic to be good, but threw in a fire because they were worried if it came out, he would it would ruin him in his political career forever. And in fact, in his race for Congress, he ran against a famous evangelist who at some point portrayed him as an infidel or at least heterodox, which he certainly was. But he was soaked in the Bible and could quote the Bible like nobody's business. And over time, under the pressure of awful personal tragedy and the pressure of the war, he became more deeply religious. Never, I believe, and this, there's a huge debate about this, Dennis, as there is about so many aspects of Lincoln, I don't believe he ever became an Orthodox Christian, but he certainly was a believer in God, and I think that second inaugural is really the most profound religious state paper and most profoundly religious state paper in American history.
He is what I call an ethical monotheist.
That would be a very good term for it.
Yeah. A lot of the founders were. The people called deists were not deists. The Aristotle notion of a mover who couldn't care less about what he moved, that I don't believe he was, but he doesn't necessarily, as you point out, had any orthodox theology.
Yeah, but it wasn't. You're right. It's not just the first mover, because famously with the Emancipation Proclamation, he tells his cabinet, I have a pact with God, and if he was going to give us this victory, which he did ambiguously, but he did in Antietam, I was going to issue this proclamation, and
mm-hmm.
So this was not an irreligious man.
Exactly. Now, the issue with his wife, does that come up?
A little bit. Again, you could write volumes about that, and people have. I'm a little soft on Mary Todd. I mean, she was very tightly wound, a little bit crazy, and became literally crazy. Again, understandably, under the pressure of the horrible things she experienced, but
and the loss of her child.
Yeah, but she was a catch for him. She was a big step up in the world for Lincoln when they got married.
Yeah, but it was pretty soon thereafter that trouble set in.
Yeah,
she had issues. She would have needed some medication that they didn't have in those days. We'll continue in a moment because I want to talk to Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, about the second part of the subtitle of his book, Lincoln Unbound. How we can do it again, that is save the American dream. Yeah, you undoubtedly see him on TV. He is a very thoughtful American. Back in a moment, I'm Dennis Prager. Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here. My book, Still the Best Hope, is out in paperback today, and I'm still having Rich Lowry on. I could have been spending the time on my own book. In fact, my publisher is probably a bit annoyed. He said, why don't you do them both on different days? But this is a very important book. It's a good one, Lincoln Unbound. It's up at DennisPrager.com. How an ambitious young rail splitter saved the American dream and how we can do it again. Let's talk about how we can do it again. Listen, you know, I derive a lot of strength and, to be honest, credibility from the fact that on my show, I really do acknowledge elephants in the room, and there is an elephant in the room, and that is that a lot of conservatives despaired after this last election. And I don't despair, but I can't blame them. We have a truly damaging administration. The left has taken over the universities and much of the media. And here you are writing that we can save it, the American dream again. So take it away, Rich Lowry.
First of all, Dennis, this is generosity above and beyond. The day your paperback is released, to have another author on, is that's unheard of.
It probably is unheard of, and it may account for my financial lack of acumen. No, I have often said when God gave out business acumen, I was in the Soviet studies line. I was in the wrong line.
Do it again. First of all, there's nothing wrong with despairing. In fact, if you look at Lincoln's Rita's rhetoric from the 1850s, it's pretty despairing because he thought we were backsliding from the days of the founders when they realized we had to preserve slavery to put together the Union, but they were embarrassed by it and they thought it would go away and they wanted to hem it in various ways. And in the 1850s, you have a different attitude in the South growing up, a more positive and affirmative case for slavery. And just Lincoln said, our Republican robe is soiled and trailed in the dust and other things of that nature. So we feel similarly today. So there's nothing wrong with a little realism and despair. I think, Dennis, the foremost crisis facing the country is not the debt, it's not the entitlements. Those things are important. It's the fact that it's hard and it's going to become harder for people to come up from the bottom of American society. And you look at kind of the crudest measures of mobility. We conservatives like to imagine America the most mobile and fluid society on earth. It's not true anymore. You have Western European countries that do better on this measure. You have other English-speaking countries doing better. You have Scandinavian countries doing better. And it's a product of some broad economic trends, but also, importantly, perhaps more importantly, even though it's neglected, of a social breakdown, where you have what I call in the book a breakdown of the basic bourgeois virtues. You know, these aren't Bible-thumping, moralizing qualities. They're just basic things like marriage, the work ethic, self-discipline, and ethic of delayed gratification. All those things are eroding away, especially at the lower end, and even now in the middle. Just if you break up the country by thirds, according to level of education, that middle group that has a high school degree has some college, maybe, but not a college degree. In 1982, those people had an illegitimacy rate of about 14%. Now it's 44%. So it's much closer to where the lower end is than the upper end. And at the upper end, that's people with college degree or more, illegitimacy rate there is 6%. So you're seeing a redistribution of social capital upwards. And if that continues, you're going to see a class divide in this country that is going to become unbridgeable. And we'll still be called America, we'll still be rich, we'll still be powerful, but we won't really be the country that we once were or the country that we should be.
Well, that's why I love you and I love National Review Online and National Review the magazine, because you realize that it's a values issue.
Correct.
The problem, values are the problem, and the left has always said, for example, poverty causes crime, and I have always said that is, in a nutshell, what they really believe. They have a materialist explanation for social pathology. We have a values explanation.
Yeah.
A defective conscience causes crime.
Right. And there's wonderful work from the Brookings Institution. And look, this is a little easier said than done in this kind of economic environment we have at the moment. But if you get a job, if you graduate from high school, if you get married without having a kid out of wedlock, you will not be poor in America. You just won't. And the problem is we have too few people that are honoring those really basic American values. So I think there are all sorts of macroeconomic things we need to do. You know, Paul Ryan has a wonderful program. But I think a deficit in the vision of contemporary conservatism largely, not doesn't include people like you, but we're all about liberty, but then we don't realize the importance of order. And you can have all the freedom in the world, but if you have this sort of social breakdown, if you have children out of wedlock, you are not going to have a truly free society. You're going to have people who aren't going to be able to make it, and it's going to create a constituency and pressure for a continued expansion of the welfare state. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the social breakdown and the growth of government proceed apace hand in hand.
Where do you live?
Manhattan.
Whenever I have a Manhattan conservative on, I ask them whether they like it. Do you enjoy living there?
We do.
And it's for the city's culture, because the ambience and the... Do you know that? I think the statistic is if everybody who lives in Manhattan who voted for Romney were put together, they would simply fill Yankee Stadium, and that would be it.
I hadn't heard that, but I'm a Yankee fan, so that's not so bad. Being at a Yankee game with a bunch of Romney voters, that wouldn't be so bad. No, we love it. We just love how lively it is, how interesting it is, the restaurants. My wife's a big opera person and a ballet person, so you have access to that. And we live in a particular slice of the city where it's basically suburban. Everyone there is a family. You know,
Where is that?
It's downtown Manhattan Battery Park. But you can also find areas like that in the Upper West Side where, again, these are people who would, if you ask them what their moral standards are in theory, it would be very disturbing answers. But if you look at the way they actually live their lives, you know, it's a version of a Leave It to Beaver existence. They're all married.
Oh, well, that's what I say. That's what I tell my liberal relatives. Why don't you preach what you practice?
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, listen, keep up the great work, and I mean it. You're really an asset. Lincoln Unbound is his book, and it is a brief and totally readable book. Look, he's the editor of National Review. He knows how to write. How an ambitious young rail splitter saved the American dream and how he can do it again. Rich Lowry, thanks for being on, and thanks for doing what you do.
Thanks so much, Dennis.
You're very welcome. That book is up. Lincoln Unbound is up at DennisPrager.com. The paperback of my book, which does make the values case, Americanism versus leftism versus Islamism, the three alternatives for humanity. The paperback is out today. Still the best hope. And by the way, if you subscribe to Pragertopia for a year or give a gift subscription for a year, you get a signed copy of the paperback for free, and it is only today. I'm Dennis Prager.